us. We are not rushing along. Well, you're perfectly free to read the Book of Mormon anytime you want to, all of it anytime you want to, as fast as you want to. That's not the idea. Now I'm pointing out a few things which you'd overlook, that you wouldn't see, and this is important things, I think. I know you overlooked them because I've overlooked them for 60 years. So, the chances are you overlooked them too. So let's consider what's on now. Now let's consider here this, the encomium of Moroni by, in Alma here. We're on the 48th chapter. The 16th to 18th verses is where he praises the qualities of Alma. This was the faith of Moroni. His heart did glory in it, not in the shedding of blood, but in doing good, in preserving his people, in keeping the commandments. Verily say, if all men had been as he were, would ever be like unto Moroni, behold, the very powers of hell would have been shaken forever. Yea, the devil would never have power over the hearts of the children of men. Notice it's the hearts he's after, not the bodies. Behold, he was a man like unto Ammon, the great pacifist, the son of Mosiah, yea, and even the other sons of Mosiah, yea, also Alma and his sons. Well, there's some things to be said now about these qualities. This shows the two qualities for which Abraham, now in the vast Abraham literature, which is very large, Abraham is mentioned perhaps more than any other person in world literature, because he is the father, he's in the center, he's the pivotal character of world history, and he's our father, he's really, we all have the blood of Abraham in us, whether we know it or not. And do you know why that is? Among other things, the chances are, we mentioned you could put it on the computer. In the time of Abraham, which is very, nobody knows the time, but we know it's one of those particular times of extermination. He lived in a time of extermination. Everything was desolate. It was always dry. He dug wells and he planted trees that he would never be able to use. The famine waxed sore in the land. He had to move from Haran to Canaan, from Canaan to Egypt, back again, driven wherever he went, and then to the five cities where it was lush, but suddenly they'd fallen on a terrible collapse. Everything collapsed. Then he moved back to Haran again, where he set up he moved to Gerar then and tried to make a living in Gerar. It was even worse, a terrible plague. Plague everywhere he went, drought everywhere, crops failed, world collapse. It was a terrible thing. Well, we'd get to take that up in the Book of Abraham, but there's a great literature about that. And the world population at that time, there's a very good work we have here, a very large, massive thing, by Claude Schaeffer, a Frenchman, got together all the archaeological evidence that covered everything we have, the signs of ruin and decay. They're periodical. 1700 B.C. was a good example, 3000 B.C. and so forth, 1200, 600, the time of Lehi, those pivotal times we talk about, so important. Well, at that time, the world's population is really reduced. It's cut down to the nub. I mean, the people just disappear. It's one of those times of extermination, the Great Plague in Europe in the 1340s, wiped out at least half the population of Europe, and in some parts, completely desolated the world. And you notice the promise to Abraham and his children, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they always lay such heavy emphasis on numbers. Your offspring, your seed, will be as numerous as the sands of the sea. If you can count the stars of the heaven, they're as numerous as the dust of the earth. That's making it infinite. Well, why are they so obsessed with getting a lot of descendants? Millions and millions are bound to get a lot anyway. Why is this an obsession with them as far as that goes? Because that's the trouble with us. We have too many people running around. The earth is overpopulated like a cancer and eating everything up now. Well, the reason is to repopulate the earth. And Abraham had three wives, his three main wives for their children. See, the first was, you remember, the first was Hagar. Well, she took Sarah, but Sarah was barren, so he took Hagar, and Hagar became, she was of the blood of Ham. Many accounts say she was the daughter of Pharaoh. She said it was an Egyptian. That's Hagar. The Egyptians play a big role here. And then his wife was Sarah. See, Hagar was and his wife, the mother in Israel, the great mother in Israel, was Sarah, mother of all the Semites. She's Semitic, you see. But Hagar is of Ham. And then Keturah, after Sarah died, he took Keturah, and she was of Shem. And she had six sons. And Abraham taught them the arts, which later became the arts of the West, the mathematics, the science, the architecture, those things in which Abraham himself was a genius. And so they spread in all directions. So we have the blood of Shem, Ham, and Jacob being refreshed in all directions, you see. And at that time, being so low, his seed became very numerous, we're told, very numerous in all these directions, which means they intermarried with everybody. And as you know, if you're a genealogist, we mix with everybody else, and before you know it, we all have the same genes all mixed up together. So there's not a chance, I don't think, that anybody, perhaps anybody in the world, is without some of the blood of Abraham in it. Because he's told repeatedly, in thee all the nations, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. The seed, especially his priesthood. So here we have Abraham going up. Now he has two great qualities. I'm going to put them on the board. By Joe, I'll do that. And they were, first of all, it always talks about Abraham's charity. Charity was dead in the world, and Abraham revived it. There was no charity, and so we'll give his first quality is charity. So many examples of that, of course. And charity is translated in the New Testament in the New Revised Version, caritas, as love. See, the greatest of these is love, it says. It says the greatest of these is charity, charis. And of course, the Latin word for charity, charis, is grace. It's cognate with our English word cheer. See, it's cognate, it's universal. Charity, love, grace, this marked Abraham, and his second was his immense intelligence, his curiosity about it. And he was a scientist. He, we know, Joseph Smith gave us the great astronomer, the cosmologist, so busy and zealous in his study of the stars and structure of things, gives us a hologram of the universe and so forth. And so then was his intelligence, which we are told, with glory of God, is light. Light and truth. Of course, light and truth, they always go together. So what we have here, you see, is what is the only begotten full of? My only begotten who is full of grace and truth, remember? Mine only begotten. These are the qualities of the only begotten Son. If you have these, this is everything. In fact, we're told that in the two great commandments. What are the first two commandments? The Lord says, on two commandments hang all the others. You keep them, you're bound to keep the others. The first is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. In Deuteronomy it says, with all thy heart, and with all thy nephesh, with all thy soul, and with all thy mild. That's a very interesting word it uses. It uses mild, which means oath, which is the same word as the old English moot, which is mind. The N drops out, you see, very often drops out before the T, but it's mind. In almost any language you can name it, it means mind. So you have to love him with all, you have to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, nephesh, with all thy mind. And so this is the intellect. Well, this is Deuteronomy 6:7, I think it is, no, 6:5. Deuteronomy 6:5. The two great commandments. First is you love him, but you love your neighbor as yourself. Now, that's another kind of love. That's charity. That's grace. See, you must love, thou shalt love thy neighbor of thyself. Of course, if you keep these, you don't need to worry about the others. If you love the Lord that much, and if you love your neighbor that much, you're not going to, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not commit adultery. You won't do any of those things if you keep the first two commandments, if they are in your heart. The Lord says, on these two commandments hang all the laws, all the prophets. If you keep them, they're taken care of. They are grace and truth. And this is grace, with all thy heart, might, mind, and say. The Lord God is the glory of God is intelligence and light and truth, and light cleaveth unto light, and so forth. So the same things in the first two commandments, they are charity for your fellow man, love. That is an intellectual sort of thing that you just feel. Abraham often did, when Satan often came and reasoned with Abraham, says, you're not being rational about this thing, supporting the people of Sodom, for example. They're bad people, he says, but I feel sorry for them. Let's save anyone. And after the battle, Abraham was worried sick. He said, there might have been a righteous man killed on the other side, and in that case, his blood would be on my head. And it bothered him terribly. What was he to do about that, you see? And these two marks, that's charity. It's not particularly rational, but it's a feeling. You have to have love is spontaneous. I mean, charity, Well, as Paul says, you don't bicker, you don't calculate, you don't work it out, you don't make intellectual plans, you don't argue about it, you don't make a Jesuitical sophistry about it. To reason, just how much love is there, as the old ancient, no, the 16th century casuists used to do. They'd figure these all things out to the fifth decimal place. No, sir. That's spontaneous, it's free, it's universal. No self-interest. Love requires nothing in return. You're not asking for that. It's not a deal, it's not an exchange, it's not business or anything like that. Love is spontaneous, so life. And the other is intelligence, which doesn't make deals in the same way, but which loves things, as Brigham Young says, light cleaveth to light. We love knowledge because it is good in itself, and we make no excuses for it. So, these two, and there are only two things which, as Irenaeus tells us, in which men can excel. They are, of course, in forgiving. That's grace, isn't it? You forgive others, you say. But I shouldn't forgive him. He did this or he did that, or it wouldn't do me this good. No, you don't ask that at all. The Arabs have a saying, the brave man never asks the odds, the generous man never asks the price, the good man never asks questions. You just forgive. You forgive, that is grace, and you repent. And repent is honest thinking. It's close, critical analysis of your own behavior. Intelligence, you see, is problem-solving ability. That's the way it's defined by William James and others. I mean, that's been the standard definition of, it used to be anyway, of intelligence by the psychologists, problem-solving ability. But what do you need to solve problems? That's a moral quality. You can't cheat. You must be honest. You don't anticipate the answer unfairly. You don't get it out of the answer book. See, problem-solving ability is a moral quality, the capacity to be strictly honest, which is very rare, you see. That's what intelligence is. It's examining your own inadequacy. The first thing you ask when you're confronted with a problem is, where am I failing? What don't I know here? Where have I broken down? Where am I inadequate for this? Then that's what you deal with, not how much have I got or something, what's my degree, or that has nothing to do with it. The thing you're interested in solving the problem is where you're weak. And it's a humiliating process, the progressive exposure of your own ignorance as you go on and on. The great Scaliger, the greatest scholar perhaps, certainly the greatest scholar of modern times, he died in the early 17th century, 1608. When he went into the ghetto in Rome to chat with the children, and so he'd learn Hebrew offhand, come from Palestine. The scholars laughed at him. They held him in contempt. We just don't do that sort of thing. They're mere children. What can they tell him? Well, they knew more Hebrew than he did, you see. And he learned it, and the others never did, as far as that goes. But this is our haughtiness. Jan Lindforth, old teacher of mine in Berkeley, when he was at the head of the American school, in Athens, he says that in the British school there, all the time he was there, he never heard any English student speak a word of Greek. They had to construe it. They had to translate it. You never read it. It wasn't, you didn't treat it like that. Just children talk languages and things like that. We treat it as sort of an abstract exercise, and so they never get very far. But these two things, you see, the problem-solving ability, that's necessary for repentance. See, learning is, intelligence is a process of progressive repentance. You repent of your mistakes you make, you repent of your stupidity, and you have to keep doing that all the time, because we don't get to first base, otherwise you'll never break through to anything. And then you say, remember, the great scientist, when he finally sees the light, almost invariably says, what a fool I've been. He's been staring me in the face all this time, and I didn't see it. See, the stars have been sending us the same hints for millions of years, or thousands of years, and we fail to respond to them. And those you respond to, they're there all the time. Just depends on your being able to see them, or being willing to see them. So this problem-solving thing. Now, Moroni tells us here is both smart and magnanimous. Notice those are the two qualities. He is smart. He always bamboozles the enemy. He runs circles around them. And he is also generous with them. They're never the enemy to him. They're always his brethren. He always stops the war the minute he sees the tide turning, the minute they start weakening and so forth. As compared with our me generation, you know, they're smart but selfish. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? This is an article from a recent psychological journal. Well, it's Psychology Today. One of the, about rich people. Titles like this, I think it's here, yeah. What good are the rich? Question mark. And asks here, yes. Are we drowning in wealth? Then this heading says, one of the sad ironies is the people who get hooked on money tend to consider themselves very smart, cool-headed, and rational. But which is the smart thing in the long run? It gives the example of Boisky here and so forth. The me generation, Boisky, Milken, the Helmsleys, and so forth. The smart dealer and the widow's cow that Brigham Young talks about. Abraham saw where real happiness lies. This is it. Notice Abraham doesn't subdue his ego at all. I mean, he doesn't wipe himself out in the niente niente or anything like that. Oh my gosh, I got everything in this pocket, including an electronic marvel. But the second verse of the first chapter of Abraham is one of the most marvelous condensations you'll find anywhere. This is Abraham's life already summed up in that second verse. So the world he lived in. It's a long one. He doesn't stop for breath. It's one sentence, that long verse. And finding there was greater happiness and peace for me. He's not ashamed of being wanting happiness and peace for himself. I said, oh, that's what you do. Don't fool yourself. Don't say, oh, I don't want anything for me at all. I just want to suffer. Stradach, 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 like the Moscow Art Theater. No, that's not it. There was greater happiness and peace and rest for me. I sought for the blessings of the fathers and the right whereunto I should be ordained to administer the same. So he only wants these blessings so he could administer them to others. To administer means to hand on, you see, to spread around, to be in charge of distribution. So that's what he wants. He wants these blessings because he's told, remember, in thee and in thy seed shall all the nations of the world be blessed. He's the greatest pronouncer of blessings that ever was. Wherever he went, he would pronounce. Well, the Lord tells him, as I commanded Adam to give my blessing to the animals, and Adam passed it on to Noah, so I now command thee, do the same thing. And he did. Of course, he took great care of the animals and birds. He was always much concerned for them. And the right whereunto I should be ordained to administer the same, having been myself a follower of righteousness, desiring all to be also to be one who possessed great knowledge, and to be a, notice he wants righteousness and knowledge, but more and more. Notice it's progressive. He doesn't stop there, notice. And to be a greater follower of righteousness and to possess greater knowledge. He wasn't satisfied with where he was. The stories of the childhood of Abraham is the most interesting thing of the childhood stories of Abraham. He was always asking questions, always researching, always doing remarkable things, and getting himself into trouble, getting his family into trouble. They had to move out. Much the same as Joseph Smith. He was very precocious. And incidentally, this is not a mythical hero. This is not a typical, you have them, you see. Typical mythical heroes, what do they do? They're strong and they're brave and they have big muscles and they fight bad people and so forth. Never is any physical prowess or characteristic of Abraham mentioned. Never his strength or his endurance or his formidable appearance or anybody. Always just his intelligence and his kindness. Those are the two things that go together where we see him, wherever we see him. One who possesses greater knowledge to be a greater follower of righteousness, and to possess greater knowledge and be a father of many nations. That's what he wanted to be, you see. You say, how ambitious, what an ego, not to be worshipped by them or anything, but to help them, give them something. He knew it. He wanted the priesthood so he could pass it on. And desiring to receive instruction. See, he was humble. He had to know how he'd go about it. And keep the commandments of God, I became a rightful heir, a high priest, holding the rights belonging to the fathers. So he could hand them down. And they came from the fathers, from the beginning of time, from the beginning, before the foundations of the earth, the right of the firstborn, the first man of Adam, has been passed down. And he sought for his appointment to the priesthood that he might administer the appointment of God concerning thy seed. His fathers had turned from their righteousness. They wouldn't listen to him or anything like that. He was in a bad world, utterly refused to listen to my voice. So we have here Abraham. That's where his real happiness lay. And the famous example, the story we all know about the man who was very smart and congratulated himself on making such a smart deal in Luke here. It's a good one, you know, 16 and 14. See, all these things would be marginal notes and footnotes in a well-edited Book of Mormon, 16. Well, for example, in this text I have here, 12:16. Every verse, this is just the Nestle edition, which is not the completest by any means, has reference to, well, they just run down. the margins are just reference to other scriptures that say the same thing, where they overlap, because it's all relevant. It's all just one book, Old Testament, New Testament, all hangs together, see? So here it says, and he said another parable to them, saying, there was a certain man who possessed a very fertile piece of land, very profitable estate, a farm. And he went around and inspected it, and he was very smart, dilegidzito. He thought it all out. He was a very shrewd businessman, in hauto legon. And he figured it all out in his mind. He said, saying to himself, what will I do now? It seems I don't have any more room. I don't have any more room to stow my present for harvest, so what can I do? There's nothing to do. To Pueso, he then says, what shall I do? I tell you what I'll do. I'll tear down the whole establishment and I'll rebuild the whole thing on a much grander scale, you see, much bigger. And then I'll have room to stow everything I have along with all my other property, too. That's just the thing. And then I can say to myself, he says, now, my friend, he says, you're as rich as Midas here. Can lay his head, you have, well, vast goods lay aside for many years to come, he says. Anapawa, retire, take it easy from now on. Anapawa, make a rest, you see. Faga pia elfrainu, eat and drink and enjoy yourself. And God said to him, you're absolute idiot. He says, Afron, meaning no brains at all. Afron, soured brain, no brains at all. Tau te te nukti tem se kain su avatai su aposu. This very night I will demand your soul of you. So he dies. Like Shivam, the great, there's a palace outside of Jordan there. It belonged to the Dajani family. They took us out there to see there's a palace built in the 9th century. The king spent 13 years building it. No, it was 27 years. It wasn't 27 years and years building it. To be the perfect palace. And it was gorgeous. It had every luxury you can imagine in it. Oh, it had hot and cold. It had tepidariums and so forth, because it was built on the Roman fashion. And even the guards had special rooms for themselves and their lady friends and so forth. And a theater. It was the works. 27 years he spent building it. And the night he was to dedicate, he was going to have the party of parties. Everybody was going to be invited. But there was an earthquake, and the piles was completely destroyed and lies in ruins today. Nobody goes back there anymore. There it is. It's a huge place. And he got a heart attack and died the same night. So that was a moral for the Arabs, you see. This is the sort of thing the chief builder himself was at. Shibam? Oh, Shibam was a big place south of there. Again, I think I always think of them after, you know. I thought of this story the last time. The minute I left the class, the one who said that Lincoln and Lee never referred to the other side as the enemy, that was Henry Steele Commager, who noted that. Well, anyway, we go on here. So we have the me generation. We're smart but selfish here. Wilford Woodruff says it's a common misconception of the Latter-day Saints that since God rewards the righteous with prosperity, the rich must be righteous. He says they have that in their system. Will they ever get it out? Well, now look, I'm going to talk about war here. And this manuscript, I was outraged to find out they were going ahead with him. But this is on Clausewitz in the Book of Mormon. This is the Book of Mormon warfare, and it is relevant. So I'm going to put Clausewitz on the... Carl von Clausewitz. I mentioned him before. The standard work on war. You can't do anything without Clausewitz. He's the one that everybody quotes. Because this is on the general principles of warfare. Not strategy and tactics. But this is... It deals, of course, with them. But this has to deal with how wars go on and the very nature of war itself. It's called Vom Kriege, On War. And it was the classic work. And the Book of Mormon reads as if it was just taken right out of Clausewitz. Carl von Clausewitz. You spell it with a W? I think that's the way you spell it here. Yes, his great work on war. We're going to talk about that. And, as I say, but there was one thing wrong with it. The marvelous thing is the timing of these things. I think they're great. You'd say Joseph Smith lifted the whole story of Moroni, the whole warfare in the Book of Mormon, out of Clausewitz. The Clausewitz was published in 1833. Too late for the Book of Mormon. They'll argue about that, of course, but no, he didn't use Clausewitz, which was only published, I say, and then was limited circulation until it became very popular. And Clausewitz was very active in the Napoleonic War, and he gives us the principles. The thing is, the principal maxims on war, he breaks it down, the great maxims of war. So the most famous saying of his is that everybody knows by heart, is war is therefore a continuation of policy by other means. It's carrying on political disagreements between nations, ideological and so forth. Policy by other means. He is strictly a soldier dealing with the technical side, only with how war is conducted. Yet he's not only going to talk about the causes in the background, here he spills the beans. This points directly to the causes, a continuation of politics. The Book of Mormon begins with war in Jerusalem and ends with war at Cumorah. In between there are a lot of wars. They all deal with political ambition. You don't have to go to Egypt, Babylonia, or Jerusalem to illustrate this, because we see territorial ambitions in such Book of Mormon characters as Zarahemla. They want to make themselves leaders of men, nations, kings, remember, and Malachi wants to lead everything. Once you start out, you don't know where to stop, like Hitler, it's the world. Zarahemla, Amulon, Amalekiah, Amoron, Laman, Nehor, Zizram, Korihor, so forth. All those are men that started great wars in the Book of Mormon out of personal political ambitions. They wanted to get ahead. They started out with political parties and ended up uniting bodies in war, such as the great coalitions of Amalekiah we've just been seeing about. We don't need to comment, as far as the present world is concerned, what is the Cold War but present politics being carried on. It's a political movement on both sides, political systems in conflict. Another saying of Clausewitz is, war belongs not to the province of the arts and sciences, but of social existence. It would be better to liken it to business competition. That's what it is, we said the money. Remember the warlords, what is their purpose? Why do they keep being warlords? Well, it's for loot, of course. That's the grandeur, that's the king. You know, the opening lines of Beowulf is a typical example. But the warlords of the steppes, they live on booty and loot. They plunder the rich cities of the plain, come down from the hills, plunder the cities of the plain, but they're always in motion, so naturally their wealth has to be transportable wealth, whereas the sedentary cities have to have sedentary wealth, like architecture and art and things like that, literature, libraries. They are stable, but people on the march have to have wealth which is portable. So what is it? It's gold, silver, and jewels. That's everything counts for them. They collect it. You see in the National Geographic, you see the tribes of the steppes, where the women all carry the family wealth in gold and silver coins around their necks. That's why the Chinese put holes in the middle of the coin so you can string them, because that's the Manchu tradition, not the Chinese. The Manchus, remember, occupied. They came the other side of the wall, just like all the rest of the people from the center go out, and the heartland, they go out and plunder the rich, luxurious, decadent cities on the outside, bring them fresh blood and ruin at the same time. So so this is portable wealth, and they place value on it. And they also things they can carry with them. That means they excel in mathematics, which they do in their heads. And and of course, the epic literature, which is always recited from memory. And the heroic literature, rather. It's the heroic age. So they have heroic literature and gold and silver. The splendors of a royal court with the king bestowing gifts upon the lords who supported him. He goes out and plunders, and he gains followers by giving them gifts, and they get more gifts by going out and plundering more. It works, and it's worked for ages and ages. It's still the same way, in fact. A large work was published in Frankfurt a few years ago. Says all the ancient state was a zu ausplundering der benachbarten Gesellschaften, was a closed corporation for the purpose of plundering neighboring communities or societies. That's where the wealth was, and it still is. You see, Hitler kept saying, "If I only had the Ukraine, all that grain, if I only had the Plötzsee oil fields, because that's where the Russians got their oil. That's what he was after. There was plunder. They were after that. Well, what do you think the English are after when they go out with their land pirates and sea pirates? Buckminster Fuller, wrote some very good things about the land pirates and the sea pirates. See, the sea pirates are those that occupy the periphery, and they have all the harbors and coasts. And who wins? The great world wars have always been between the land powers and the sea powers. The Trojan War was that sort of a thing. See, the Mycenaeans came in their 1,000 ships, and Troy is well inland. It dominates the plains and so forth. But it's the same way. It's the land pirates, sea pirates. And so far, the sea pirates are in most of the time. They can block them up. Well, Clausewitz, writing back in the... So he says, war belongs not to the province of arts and sciences, but that of social existence, to call it business competition. Now, this was written, you see, in the end of the 19th century. He was in the Napoleonic Wars. The early 18th century. When was it written? It was first published in 1833, so it was when he was teaching in the Kriegsschule. It was in the 1830s. It's like business competition, more like politics, we're quoting him. It may be regarded as a kind of business competition on a great scale. Well, Clausewitz is writing back in the 18th century during the Napoleonic Wars. His main study was wars of the 18th century, wars of princes and kings following the grandeur, the idea to be grandeur. You have to be grand and rule the world, you see. The prince's business is a contradiction of terms to say there's such a thing as a kinglet. To be a king, you have to acknowledge no limit to your rule. Otherwise, you're just a dependent if you don't rule everything. So every king has to rule everything. Any enemy on his borders is a threat to him, a challenge to his supremacy. And so he has to make war on his enemies. And this went on, my man. It went on terribly. Wars of princes following the grandeur of Louis the Great. That's bad, I should change. It was all important to be grander. You had to annex as much land as you could. Why? Say, like the partition of Poland between Catherine between Austria and Prussia. They've departed Poland and Russia, Catherine the Great. She wept, but she took, as Frederick the Great said. She wept, but she took. They had to annex as much land as you could because you grabbed not only the resources, but in that time it was important to grab all the people because they made up the army for grabbing more land. You see, they were the peasants. They automatically fell to you. That's the Asiatic system. It's a chess game. The winner take all, you see. And without any hesitation, this is best represented in the Book of Ether. Well, we get to that anyway. They strengthened your army and aggrandized you and made you greater and you could expand more. They strengthened you and enabled you to make further sweeps. And this occurred throughout the 17th, 18th century. Well, most of all, the 14th, 15th century was really wild. Everybody grabbed as much land as they could. The princes doing it in the interests of the state. It was ratio status which justified anything, which we would just say national security is really ratio status, would justify anything. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the great industrial barons were after the same thing, land, because along with that came raw materials and cheap labor and markets, you see. That's why they wanted colonies in the 18th and 19th centuries. England grabbed a third of the world because it provided raw materials, it provided cheap labor and markets. And so it went on, a territorial wars. Clausewitz continues, moreover, politics is the womb in which war is developed. It is business on a great scale. Nothing describes it better these days better than that. So we don't need to explain that. And then he says, disarming the enemy. This is the object of war in the abstract, the final means of attaining a political object, forcing the enemy to disarm. And we've always disarmed the enemy after every war, you see, and immediately armed them again. But disarming the enemy is the object of war, not to destroy him, you can profit greatly. After all, the Germans and the Japanese were the most enterprising people in the world. After America, at that time now, they've left us behind. But disarming the enemy was the object of the war, and the final means, that's what you're really after. In the Book of Mormon, Moroni often requires the enemies to lay down their arms. This happens again and again, and he lets them go home. There are no reprisals, nothing. I say the war always takes place on Nephite society. If they just go home and promise they won't come back, that's all he ever asks of them. No reprisals or anything similar. In the 44th chapter of Alma, 15th, 20th, 52nd, 37th, so forth. The test comes when they lay down their arms. Then they know your will has dominated over. Then you know your will has dominated over theirs, and they know it too. So Clausewitz says the disarming of the enemy is the object of war. Moroni was satisfied when the enemy laid down their arms. Likewise, the French and Indian Wars and the Mexican Wars and the last war, when the Germans and Japanese laid down their arms, the war was over. That's all it took. They just laid, that's what ended the war. So Clausewitz's next maxim, it's an interesting one too. The aggressor always pretends to be peace-loving. See, we're always on the defensive. Because he would like to achieve his conquest without bloodshed. Hitler would be glad to have taken all of Europe without any bloodshed at all. If you let him have what he wants, he's dandy. Anybody would do that, you see. Therefore, aggression must be presented as a defensive reaction against the aggressor nation. Your aggression is always represented, we're quoting Clausewitz here, as being a defense action. You're just defending yourself. They are the aggressors, quoting that thing of Hitler's. Nobody ever attacks. You're always just on the defensive. After World War I, the German office, the Kriegsamt, changed its name to Wehrmacht Defense Power, and we changed our name, War Department, to Department of Defense. We're just defensive now, that's all. Both sides must take a defensive position, whether they're aggressors or not. We see good examples in the Book of Mormon in the case of Gideon and Meconius. The heads we get to them, they're the heads of the robber armies, the fact they could have robber armies that would overthrow governments. Now we're getting something that in the Medellin, you see, the same sort of thing. That here's a gang of robbers that can actually defy governments, including our own, and get away with it. It's happening more frequently. That's the Book of Mormon. And then that always happens in Book of Mormon lands. That's where this happens. So this is the tradition down there. And the Book of Mormon trains you up to all this sort of thing. Gideon, he writes to Laconius in Nephi, in 3rd Nephi, when you get to that, 9 and 10. Not 3rd Nephi, it must be 2nd Nephi. We wouldn't bother you except you're infringing on our rights of government, our ancient society, which is old and venerable. You've been the aggressors against us. And the Lamanites always had that legitimate agreement, a legitimate charge. They always would explain how they, Laman and Lemuel, were robbed by Nephi and his trickery and so forth. They really believed it. Since the loser must always submit to the winner, each side is always fighting for its freedom, because if you lose, you'll lose your freedom. So every side, we're always fighting for freedom, no matter which side you're on. I don't want to submit to you, you don't want to submit to me, so I'm defending my freedom and you're defending your freedom. We have a defense department operating at present all throughout the world, where we feel we need to be defended in bases everywhere. And quoting Clausewitz again, those who belong to the profession will always look upon themselves as a kind of guild. So it's a profession, a corporate guild, a closed corporation. Must exist more or less in every army. That's true. Military virtue is a quality of standing armies only. And yet it's the citizen soldier who does all the fighting. But most of the time, because that's why they have this cult. I mean, when you have to, what other business requires you to wear a special outfit all the time and decorate yourself with visible symbols of every remarkable thing or praiseworthy thing you ever did? You can't do anything praiseworthy without putting a ribbon or a medal on. That's a strange thing, of course, in Europe they do. They just cover themselves. It's marvelous how they can do it. Every time you turn around, you pin another medal on. This is true, though. Well, let's see now. He says, it is impermissible. Now, this is interesting. It is professionalism which guarantees ongoing tradition, but it's also a very dangerous thing. Now, Clausewitz says, it is impermissible and even harmful to leave a great military event to purely military judgment. Don't leave it to the army, because for various reasons. The influence of the cabinet of any military man, except the commander-in-chief, he says, is extremely dangerous, because they have their own interest, their own purpose, and so forth. And if they agree or disagree with the government, they have the power to take over, which what happens in Central and Latin America again and again and again and again. If you get the army, if you have the strongest army, then you take over the government, then you are the government. That's what Noriega did. He lost the election, but he had the army, he had enough force, so he took it over. So here it is, he says. That's why it's impermissible, even harmful, to leave a great military event to purely judgment. The influence in the cabinet of any military man, just the commander-in-chief who has to be represented, it's very dangerous, because then it's very easy for them to take everything over. It's not the business of military men to meddle in higher politics of state. The chief military commander is the only one who should be in the cabinet. Harmful, impermissible for the military even to participate there, because, as I say, they have their own interests and they do things differently, impulsive. When you have the power and you want to go ahead, well, let's go ahead. Well, we've just seen this last week an interesting example of that. We still have the fog of war there to deal with, but here you see, Noriega was finally, he was taken, he was held, We could have gone in and taken him, but we didn't, you see. The military didn't. They got their wires crossed. It always happens, incidentally. It always happens. He's going to talk about that. Wars are always messed up. He says nothing is going to go straight. And get that straight. This is absolutely basic with Clausewitz and important, too. A good example of the last, though, is Moroni getting on his high horse when he writes to Pahorn, remember? He speaks as a general in the midst of war. He blows his tops and writes a very indiscreet letters. And he's absolutely wrong, you see. Though the great Moroni, he doesn't understand what's going on back home. He's writing to Pahorn about conditions he isn't aware of at all. He's going to take over. He says, we'll come and seize the state. We'll expel you. I'll march with my men and we'll unseat you, he says in the 60th chapter of Alma we get to here. I'll just take over the government myself. And Pahorn writes and said, you just don't understand what's going on. Pahorn's very, very, very wise about it. Doesn't take any offense. He says, I admire your great heartedness. It's the way you should be. And then he explains. And then Moroni apologizes and they work very closely together from then on, are able to mop up the war. They'll finish it up. They just work hand in glove after that. The first maxim is, it's politics by other means. The second maxim is, war is thus an act of force to compel our adversary to do our will. That's what you want, not to eliminate him. War is nothing but a duel on a larger scale. That's Clausewitz again. And of course, that's what it is in the Book of Mormon. Remember, we in this chapter here, the personal, it was entirely a personal thing between Alma and Malachi when it climaxes with Malachi threatening to drink Alma's blood, not Alma, excuse me, Moroni's blood, threatening to drink Moroni's blood. They're that worked up. It's a personal feud between the two, and it is so between the generals. The first week in Normandy, General Taylor wanted me to go over to the German colonel and invite him to tea in the manner of the 17th, 18th century wars, you know. He actually did, certainly. So I got my uniform, I got all dolled up, went over to invite the colonel. He was holding Carentan and he held it. He didn't lose it. General Taylor, who was the Germans called him the letzte gentleman, the last gentleman. So he had to do the glamorous, romantic thing and go over and invite the under white flag and go over and invite the colonel to tea. Well, it was called off the last minute when all hell broke loose over there. And, we talked about Colonel Cole the last time, who went off to take Sertogenbosch. He led the only bayonet charge in World War II. That was the same week when they took the bridge at Carentan by a bayonet charge. They didn't need to take it by a bayonet charge. We lost a lot of casualties because machine guns worked very efficiently, you know, better than bayonets. But the 502nd actually took the bridge at Carentan in the bayonet charge. You know. He thought we were going to go right through it the way they did in World War II. It didn't work that way. But the that's an act of war to compel our adversary to do our will. Nothing but a duel on a larger scale. No, it's personal. Alma fights Amalekai. Well, this is proceeding. Amalekai face to face. That's a duel. But they represent the forces. Amalekai swears, as I say, to drink Moroni's blood. Of course, the classic is Shiz versus Coriantumr, when they both exterminate each other. We still do the same today. We try to destabilize governments which do not favor us, which we do not favor. We personify them in their leaders. The leader or whoever is in charge becomes the villain, and because a personal duel between his president and this president and that president, whichever they might be, and they take it very personally. Of course, Reagan took things very personally. Clausewitz goes on to say, quote again, if the enemy should choose the method of great decision by arms, our own method must on that account be changed against our will to a similar one. If they're going to fight, we've got to fight. What the enemy does, we must do. Clausewitz goes on and says, if the enemy should choose the method he's going to use of the great decision of arms, we can't do anything but reply in the same way. We must on that account, against our own will, adopt a similar method. Moroni repeatedly found that the enemy had copied his equipment and his tactics in armies, and war armies always look alike. They always do, of course. We must copy their methods. If you have a helmet that's superior, a gun that's superior, it's only a matter of weeks that we, the other side, has the same thing, because they can't allow you to enjoy that advantage for any length of time. So the two sides look just alike. The Germans had very good tanks, far, far better than the Pershing, so we quickly had to change ours from a Pershing. And the same way, as soon as the Russians introduced the Shepetovka and it worked very well. Then the Germans had it, and then we got the bazooka and so forth. But the German gray uniform was superior to ours in World War II because it was less visible. So we made all uniforms look alike. Now everybody goes around in camouflage. The first time those camouflage things were worn, where the parachutes were made with that leaf effect on them, and we wore that kind when they landed not in Normandy, but in Holland. The second time we learned our lesson. So you always end up, if they have something good, you can't let them enjoy that advantage very long. You have to have a gun just as good. Their 88s were far superior to what we had, so we immediately had to counter with 150. And things like that. So, what the enemies do, we have to do. Change to a similar one. If the enemy should choose method, the great decision of ours, we can't do anything but reply the same. And then he says, well, Moroni repeatedly found the enemy had copied his tactics, equipment and tactics. That's what made the war draw out for 14 years, because every time he got something good, the Nephites would do the Lamanites would do the same thing. He couldn't fool them anymore. The trick with the lines, or the fortifications, or the falling back, or the leading into a pocket, all these things, they caught on very quickly and did the same thing. And so the war dragged on. In another place, Clausewitz says, in modern times, the armies of European states have arrived very much on a par in discipline and training. Again, that's the same thing. They have to mount up. This is what we've been doing for the last 40 years. We can't allow the Russians to get an edge on us. If they have a certain kind of missile, we've got to get that kind of missile. If they have more tanks, we've got to get more tanks. And this goes on all the time. And there's submarines, and there's always this balance, this playing this game all the time. And it's enormously costful, because each side knows the other wouldn't dare use those missiles, because it'd all be over for both sides if they started doing that. That's rather silly, isn't it? But this is the way Satan says, peace will be taken away from the world, and the devil will have control in his own dominion. I will take the treasures of the earth, convert them into cash, gold and silver, and now buy up kings and presidents, posts and priests, armies and navies, and rule with blood and horror. And this is what's going on. It hasn't relaxed in the least after all these years. It's pretty sad that the Book of Mormon should be so cruelly relevant in our own time, isn't it? It's hard on us. Well, so he says, you can see why we can't allow the enemy to get a new gun, whether it's Shepetov, we immediately a copy of it in the bazooka. The Mark VI Panzer, that was awfully good. We counted with the Persian. We can't allow them to hold an edge, and we just said that. So armies very quickly come to look very much alike. Hence the duel in which the parties are necessarily equal. There'll be very little difference between them when they meet, and that's very destructive. When the Lamanites tried to encircle the Nephites with the same wine tricks the Nephites had tried, the Nephites then tried other tricks, but the tricks didn't work anymore because the enemy knew them all by heart, and both had adopted each other's method. Continuing on the idea of the duel of equal parts, Clausewitz writes, the ruthless use of force, who shrinks from no user of force, it'd be usually the ruthless user of force who shrinks from no amount of bloodshed must gain an advantage if his opponent doesn't do the same. War is war, he says, and don't try to talk about the civilized war or the rules of war. That's ridiculous, the contradiction of terms. If there are rules or laws, you wouldn't fight, you'd talk about it. You know, when you start scratching and biting, it's because the rules don't hold anymore, you're not paying any attention to them. So you must be ruthless. Now, Teancum and Malachi typify this. Well, generally, Lehi is a good example. Moroni's second-in-command, Lehi, he was a holy terror. But Teancum was the worst. Well, he was, was Lehi's chief of staff. And Amalekai typified the principle, the other side. It's always the wicked against the wicked in the Book of Mormon, never the righteous against the wicked. It's a duel between Amalekai and Alma. We mentioned this before. Wasn't that a good guy against a bad guy? No, when the war was over, they mourned terribly because they were convinced that the war had been because of their wickedness. They had brought it on themselves. They weren't fighting bad guys as good guys after all, the way Mormon counsels. Don't worry about the wicked. Behold, the justice of God will overtake the wicked, and it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. Clausewitz describes the old-fashioned wars as punishment wars. We can't afford that luxury now. We must copy the enemy if he's bloody-minded. The Lord gives a rule right at the beginning of the Book of Mormon. The second chapter says, the wicked Lamanites, they'll have no power over thy seed, except they shall rebel against me also. When they fight, it's because they're both rebellious against God. Otherwise, there's going to be no fight. They will have no power over thy seed unless they rebel against me also. I'll keep things going. That was the agreement, and it's repeated throughout the Book of Mormon. Clausewitz says, because we're so equal, the wastage of our own forces is always the greater, the more our aim is directed toward destruction of the enemy forces. The more we are determined on destroying them, the more we will be destroyed. He says, that's a rule to follow, because you must. I used to have an old teacher at UCLA in the boxing class, he used to say, the first rule is, If you want to hit, you got to take a chance on getting hit. He was a little Irish. If you want to hit, you got to take a chance on getting hit. The same thing. If you're going to destroy the enemy, you've got to take a chance on getting destroyed yourself. There's nothing, no way you can do it from a position of safety. I see the time is up now. In other words, the harder we try, which is represented, of course, by the Book of Mormon's total extermination story, Shiz versus Coriantumr, they exterminate each other. Although such a thing can never happen, according to Clausewitz, we know that such a thing can. It's kill. It isn't kill or be killed, which is used all the time in the infantry. Kill or be killed. Teancum is an example. Kill and get killed. Teancum was a general just like General Johnson there who stood up in the canal and refused to duck. And he was too proud, but he was bloody-minded. And so I say, if you get to be a general by the age of 25, you must be pretty gung-ho. And he was, but didn't last long. Anymore, the Teancum, he got himself killed because he was always going out on those sprees. And the Nephites and the Lamanites too. The Lamanites decided it became completely disrupted at Cumorah, as well as the Nephites. What a wastage. The Lamanites lost at the Battle of Cumorah just as much as the Nephites. Remember, they were scattered and there was nothing but one revolution throughout the whole land. And Moroni says, I don't know when it'll end. It's just endless. And it didn't. So you must risk your own forces at whatever cost. If you're going to destroy, you must be destroyed. You must accept that, says Clausewitz. That's the rule. I see time is up now, but I'm going to have to do some complaining about this.